Hello, everybody. Dr. F. Scott Feel here, and I'd like to introduce you to our newest sponsor. The NPTE Final Frontier is the review course that I wish was around when I took the board exam. For those of you who know my story, it took me a handful of times to pass that exam, and quite frankly, I really wish I had an exam review course around, just like the NPTE Final Frontier. Check out their website, npteff.com, and use the code HET at checkout for 10% off to all of our listeners and fans. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Feel, and I'm very fortunate today to be joined by a colleague of mine who actually is a pretty bigwig in my university where I'm currently employed. So I'm excited to welcome Dr. Brian Goldstein. Brian, thank you so much for being here. Tell us a little bit about your academic journey and how it's led you to where you are today.
Well, thanks, Scott. I appreciate the time. I appreciate being on the podcast and following the other esteemed individuals that you've had, and happy to join you and talk with your listeners in one way or another. So my background as a health science rehab professional is in the field of speech language pathology. And so I finished my undergraduate degree at Brandeis University in outside of Boston, where I majored in linguistics and cognitive science. And I love linguistics. I love theory, but I like theory that relates to practical application. And I knew that was where my interest really needed to focus. And so I decided and needed to go to graduate school to further my career, and you know, in the same way that you did and our OT colleagues do, et cetera, to practice and get a master's degree, which is still the entry-level degree in speech language pathology. And I was super fortunate that one of my roommates in college was from the Philadelphia area. And I had born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina. I went to Boston because I wanted to get a different experience than what I had grown up in the South, and really enjoyed going to college in the suburbs of Boston, being able to take a quick train ride into the city where my friends and I spent most every weekend taking in the sights in Boston. Well, at least the ones that we could afford when we were undergrad. But I really wanted a large urban city for grad school. And so he was from Philadelphia. He said, have you considered Temple University, which is right in the heart of Philadelphia and North Philadelphia, or North Philly, as we call it. And so I went to grad school at Temple. And my particular interest also was in non-English speaking, particularly Spanish English bilingual populations. And Temple had not only the grad program in the city that I wanted to go to, but also they had a bilingual emphasis program. And so I was part of that as a master's student. So I graduated at Temple. I also got, so speech language pathology, like PT, is a generalist degree, right? So you're expected to have entry level skills. And so I appreciated that, but I also was frustrated by it somewhat, in the sense that I knew a lot about a variety of different things, but I really wanted to know something in depth. And so I kind of got bit by the research bug early on in my master's program. I did a master's thesis. And so when I left Temple as a master's student, I had an idea that I would probably go back and get my doctorate. But you know, I had been in school like everybody else since kindergarten and needed a break. So I moved back to the Boston area. Spent 2 years as an SLP, as a clinician at Mass General Hospital, both in acute care and outpatient, with a large Latino, Spanish English, Spanish only, bilingual, monolingual population. And then actually went back to Temple to work on my PhD, and then started my, I guess, traditional academic career. My first job was as assistant professor at St. Louis University. So moved from Philadelphia to St. Louis, was there, then moved back to Philadelphia for a faculty position at Temple. And so that's sort of my, I guess, my educational academic trajectory.
Yeah, I love the fact that we have more speech language pathology representation now on the show. It's been a while, so I appreciate that. But the main reason that we've got you on today is to talk about your current position now of Chief Academic Officer at the University of Health Sciences there at St. Augustine. So tell us about what that is. What define for us, if you will, a Chief Academic Officer. What does that look like? Because not every school has that.
They don't, or at least they don't call it by that name, or sometimes it's used as more of a descriptor than of the job title itself. So in my previous role, so I've been at the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences for 2.5 years. October will be my 3-year anniversary at St. Augustine, or as we call it, as you know, USA or USAHS. And I came originally as the Dean for College of Rehab Sciences, which is not only SLP, but also our PT and OT programs. And then transitioned into the interim chief academic officer in January of 2020. By the summer of that year, was made permanent CAO, and I have that title. A couple of weeks ago, added the role of president. So now I'm both president and chief academic officer. But anyway, specifically to your question, Scott, so most universities have a role that is chief academic officer, even if they don't call it that. So previously, I was at LaSalle University, also in the Philadelphia area. I'm now located in absolutely gorgeous, beautiful San Marcos, California. I was provost and vice president for academic affairs. So some universities call this role CAO, chief academic officer. Some call it provost, which has a very interesting sort of history behind it, and or vice president for academic affairs. And by and large, the CAO is the leader for all of the academic programs and academic activities across the university, or in our case, given that we are a university made up of 5 campuses in 3 states in 3 time zones, I ostensibly oversee all of the academic programs and activities across all of those programs and campuses. So that is the essence of the role. You know, I also see it as somewhat of the safeguarding and the view of academic quality, of student outcomes, of student experience, and service to our students in their entire the entirety of their academic program.
Yeah, you know, not too heavy or anything, right? Not too much of a load. Tell us
It keeps me busy for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned this a little bit, and I'd like you to just touch on it, but you said provost has kind of an interesting background to it. Go ahead and talk to that a little bit. Let us know what that kind of looks like.
So, I mean, the word, as I understand it, actually derives from French for, ironically, jailer, or someone who's in charge of the jail, which is sort of interesting and perhaps somewhat ironic, right, given now its link with higher education. And I think I think the word derived only to in the attempt to pull together a disparate group of people that I think because of background, context, education, authority, are often difficult to coalesce into a coherent, sort of organized set of guidelines and principles. And so I think that is likely why the term ended up being for the moniker for a chief academic officer.
Yeah, I took French in high school, so I thought that's what it was alluding to, which is why I asked. But let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about, how do you even become a chief academic officer? What is the path or the journey to that? Like, what does that look like? And did you aspire to be that? Was that something you had always thought you would do? Or did it just kind of keep happening based on the steps that you took to get there?
No, I always think of myself as an accidental administrator. It was not something that I ever intended to do. You know, in fact, even though, you know, I went back, I got my doctorate, was a, you know, on the pathway, the typical pathway of faculty, going from assistant to associate to full professor. I was at institutions where tenure was granted. So obtained tenure and promotion to full professor and was on that trajectory, doing the triumvirate, right? Doing the troika of teaching, research, and service, was busy publishing, at least applying for grants, getting some external funding and enjoying, you know, service opportunities. And so I did that for 11 years before I was voluntold into my first leadership position, which I wasn't looking for. So as I mentioned, I had had a history at Temple University. I'd been there twice as a student, and I was there for about 8 years as a faculty member, where one afternoon, the dean asked to talk to me. And, you know, usually as a faculty member, that's not generally a good thing. You know, you kind of want to avoid the dean if at all possible, except for, you know, maybe having a glass of wine at a faculty reception. And so, you know, he said to me, look, I've seen the work that you've done as a faculty member. You know, you seem to have the respect of your colleagues. Your current chair is moving on. Would you be interested in at least stepping in as an interim department chair and program director, which at the time those roles were separated, were in the same person. So I would have to be not only the chair of the department, which included both undergrad, grad, doctoral, accredited and not accredited programs, but also the program director for the accredited master's program in speech path. And, you know, I'm a person, Scott, that when there's an opportunity, I'm like, I'll try it. You know, I'll see if I like it. So I said yes, or as I like to joke, you know, when he asked for volunteers, I was the only one dumb enough not to take a step backwards. So it ended up being me.
That's a lot of hats. I'm not going to lie. That sounds like a lot. But again, leaders lead, right? So you go for it. You try it. You step into that role. And that's where it kind of brought you today, you know?
It did. But in all honesty, so I was interim for 2 years. I stepped back out of the role for a year. And then I was permanent chair and program director for the 3 years after that. You might be, well, why did you step out? Well, I stepped back out of it after the second year is because I absolutely hated it. I hated it. I did not like administration. I did not like the management. I will say I saw my colleagues in a very different light being department chair than I did when I was a rank and file faculty member and their colleague just eating lunch with them. And also, you know, I think more importantly, I was not really ready mentally or developmentally to make the leap in a career change from my faculty role into administration and leadership. And so when the dean asked me after year one to continue into year two, because we had a failed search for the department chair, I said, you know, I will do it. However, here's my quid pro quo. I will do it only if I can spend 3 days a week in the chair's office and go back to, and I called it this, I called it my real office on the second floor, which was my faculty office, where again, I could focus on teaching, research, and service. I had my research lab up on the second floor. And that's really where, you know, I think still my passion laid. We hired a department chair. That didn't work out. And so the department was in flux a little bit. And, you know, so I said, I'd sort of come to terms with that maybe I was starting to make a mental change in my life trajectory. I didn't quite know it exactly then, and agreed to step back into the role, but only if it would be as permanent chair. I was not interested in being another interim for another year or two. And then it evolved from there. It was an evolution. It was not a revolution in my mindset and thinking in the transformation from faculty into leadership.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times that's kind of how it happens is leadership is there, right? It's maybe underlying a little bit sometimes, but you get put into positions and roles and situations and, you know, iron sharpens iron type situation where you just keep getting better and better and better at those situations. And if you get real good at it, they ask you to do more, you know? So it's one of those situations that I see happen a lot of times within leaders, you know?
Right. And that's why I think it is an evolution. And you know, I was fortunate to have some really good mentors, which I know, you know, you've talked to your other guests about on your podcast, the importance of mentorship and having that person who first taps you on the shoulder and sees something in you that maybe you don't see yourself, and then also is willing to invest their time and treasure into your development. I'll also say, you know, I think there's been, you know, a couple transformative individuals and also transformative experiences that I've had. So, you know, as I was going on this journey, and it absolutely is a journey, you know, I was also fortunate to have a dean who said, "Hey, your department's doing well. You know, I appreciate the leadership that you've exercised. Are you interested in a larger project? And you know, I have something here at the college level. So at Temple University, it was 17 different schools and colleges. And so I was in the College of Health Professions, and then the Health College of Health Professions and Social Work. And he said, I got a couple projects that I'd really like your help on. Would you do that? And I think he was kind of testing me. I really do. I think he was looking to see whether I could handle a little bit of a bigger project. And from that, I moved into an associate dean role, and then had the transformative experience of being sent to the Harvard Management Development Program, which is an intensive 2-week on-campus boot camp that was absolutely transformative, not just in my career, but in my life, that helped settle me to go from that accidental administrator to a career change.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we need that, right? Sometimes we need those little interventions along the way. You know, it helps build what we think we're trying to accomplish, which then may open doors, you know, to other opportunities as they present themselves. But now, you know, you've made it up to the pinnacle, essentially, of academia, right? Now we're president and chief academic officer. And first off, again, congratulations on that. They've kind of added more hats and more responsibility to you, shifted around some things, and that now you're there. Now that you're on the other side and you've made it to that pinnacle, what are some of the traits and what are some of the things that you find either in yourself or that you've seen in other people in your position? If people are interested in maybe going that path and working up the ladder to try to become, you know, one of those positions, what are some traits that you think you look for or that you've seen in other leaders?
So I'm going to start this with one of the traits that I've become, I guess, known for here at USA, and that's to quote people who are way smarter and have more experience than I do. So I'm going to start with one of those, and that's from Stephen Sample, who was the former president of the University of Southern California, who said, and he was talking about presidents because it was a book I read on being president. And he said, people have to not just want to be the president, they have to want to do the president. So I think there are some folks who, for whatever reason, look at leadership positions as, you know, some sort of marker of authority or power. And don't want to actually do the work that it takes to succeed in those roles. And so, you know, I would take out whatever the position is, and it doesn't even have to have a formal title attached to it. So, you know, it could be adjunct or contributing faculty or faculty member or associate professor, and say, you've got to want to not just be that role, but also do that role. And so part of what he says too is, look, ideally, you know, leaders should spend about 70% of their time in strategy and about 30% in operations. And so you can't just be the person sitting back and thinking great thoughts, although you need to be able to do that and spend some time doing that. But you've got to do the work as well, right? It's not just about, again, being the leader, it's also doing the leader. And you know, one thing, you know, no one can accuse me of is not having done now every academic role in higher ed. You know, again, I've been a program director, a department chair, a project manager, an associate dean, a dean, an executive dean, a provost, a chief academic officer, and now, you know, I'm only a few weeks into it, you know, president of a university. And so I haven't skipped a step. And for me, that was important, you know, that I didn't have designs on, oh, now I'm a department chair. Now I'm ready to be a president. No, I absolutely was not. And I think I'm a better all of those things because I've gone through each of the other steps. And so again, wanting to dig in and do the work is an important trait, along with for me, you know, one of the things, I guess when I go back and look at even my early course evaluations, which, you know, sometimes I, you know, close my eyes intently and then open them and look back at those course evals and what students said, even from, you know, my first classes, was my passion about the work that I do. And I've not lost that passion in, you know, 30 years of being in higher ed. So I'll just start with those two.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on a lot of really good points there. You know, I think definitely you've got to want to put in the work, right? There has to be some sort of work ethic. You can't just tap out at, you know, 9 to 5, clock in, clock out, right? You got to want more than that for yourself, you know, but also for the bigger picture, right? For the next wave of students that are coming through, or, you know, your other peers and coworkers, right? You've got to want to have that impact and be more and do more. You know, I think that definitely is part of it. But you also brought up a good point too, in having that passion and not losing it. You know, I think if we even talk a little bit about being all the roles and following the blueprint, you know, it kind of parallels with business, right? Like when you start a business, I know a lot of my friends who have started private practices, and they were just like I was. They were the front desk person. They were the towel folder. They were the, you know, janitor. They were the therapist, you know, they were the biller. They did all the roles, and little by little, they found what they had to do to be successful in those roles, and then found people to fill those roles as they built up and were eventually able to work on their business instead of in their business, you know? So it's following that blueprint, knowing every touch point along the way, that I think becomes, you know, very important when you're trying to, you know, work your way up to positions like that. And, you know, I really do. I love the fact that you've kind of got that lead from within view on things, where it's like, you know, doing the role and being there with you as we go through this. And as we try to, you know, the cliche phrase that, you know, rising tide raises all ships. Like, I want to be there with you all, helping you move along the way. And that to me is more leadership than, like, you know, dictatorship, follow me, this is what you need to do, you know. I think we're seeing a bigger shift in leadership nowadays, that's really what a good leader is, you know, somebody who's right there in the thick of it with everybody, trying to get the best out of everybody.
I hope so. I mean, yeah. Again, to me, that's what drives me when people ask me, because, you know, sometimes as chief academic officer, you know, which is where, you know, we started this conversation, was it's sometimes abstract in some ways to understand, you know, what that job is and what that role is. But when people say to me, well, what is your job? What I tell them is, my job is to help other people do their jobs better. That is really my role. And so one thing I've done, look, you know, kind of going back to the trajectory, I appreciated that someone tapped me to be a department chair. But I was absolutely, totally unprepared to be a department chair. I walked out of my faculty office on a Friday and walked into the chair's office on Monday. No real preparation other than, now I had a little bit more time, so I devoured, you know, every book on being a department chair. And luckily there's lots of those that are around. There's lots of books on being a dean. There's almost nothing on being a chief academic officer. You know, in fact, as I'm now looking across my desk to my bookshelf, you know, I've got the two books together that I know that are published on being a provost or a chief academic. Two books. Maybe there are more if I did a Google search.
But we can expect your book anytime now, then, right? That's what I'm hearing.
No, I don't know. You know, when I do writing, in addition to lots of emails and reports, you know, I try to keep my hand in my research and still enjoy and really do miss academic writing. But so anyway, so what, you know, one thing I've done, because I was wholly unprepared to move into a leadership role, was I sat down and I did a vision and a mission statement and kind of core values and responsibilities, because, you know, I wanted to have that touchstone with me. And I've altered that document in every job that I've ever had. And as I've moved, if you will, up, or somebody, people would say down the academic ladder, and now in this role. And so it serves to keep me grounded and aligned with my own core values and who I am and what I want to be and how I want to function in this role. But again, my role is to help other people do their jobs better. That's it. It's pretty, in some ways it's simple. It's hard, but it's also simple at some level.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think another theme that I'm gathering is reflection. You know, you're very thoughtful about going back and looking at the things that got you to where you are and that have helped you along the way. And I think obviously there's been a lot of research out there that shows that reflection is really one of the differences between novice clinicians and expert clinicians, right? Same thing can be applied, I'm sure, for academic leaders, you know, so reflection's a big one. You know, I think I try to preach that to my students especially, but you know, if we could give the audience maybe one or two tips that you have for somebody who is looking to really get into leadership and maybe think that may be a path for them. What's another tip or two that you would give them to help them along their journey?
Well, first of all, I think they shouldn't see a leadership position as a once and done opportunity. That if they're interested in something and they don't put themselves forward, that it's going to go away forever, right? There are way more opportunities than there are really good people to fill those opportunities, and that window will always be open. I think second is be brave. If you have a little bit of an interest, either take on a project or go to someone and say, hey, you know, I might have some interest here. Do you have some work for me to do? Yeah, it might be additive at first in terms of what you're doing. I think third is look for opportunities, and there are lots of opportunities. You know, if somebody came to me right now, I'd have probably five or six things I could tick off to them and say, hey, here's some projects that either are on the shelf or languishing a little bit because, you know, we just don't have the personnel to implement those projects and provide leadership for a project or two. Third is to look for someone who you think can mentor you if you have a desire or an interest or just have questions, and say, let's sit down and over an adult beverage or a cup of coffee or a glass of water, let's just talk about what this is, to take the mystery out of it. Because, you know, look, certainly, you know, when I was a faculty member, I was lucky that, you know, I had access to the dean of a graduate school and a provost, even as a very young faculty member. You know, I didn't have much access, you know, in other places to leaders who were, you know, if you will, higher up on the org chart. So certainly, you know, put yourself in a position to just meet those folks, whether it's at a reception or a mixer, or again, volunteer and say, you know, you want to get involved at that level. Because what you find is there's much less mystery and kind of work going on behind the green velvet curtain than you might think that there is. So those are at least a few things of how you can kind of put yourself out there and slowly build up those opportunities for yourself and try some things out before you make a commitment and say, oh my gosh, I'm going to leave, if you will, the comfort of my faculty position and become a program director or department chair.
Yeah, you hit some really high points there, some great takeaways. One, the opportunities, like, you know, I'm not a huge believer in luck. I'm a believer that if you work hard enough, eventually opportunities will present themselves, and the hard work will allow you to pounce on those opportunities and excel at them when they do present, you know? And so I think, you know, again, like you said, going out of your way, asking for, you know, projects or work or things that could maybe help you. But the other thing too is the networking, right? Like you said, I can't remember who said the quote, but it's essentially you are the sum of the five people that you surround yourself with the most, right? So it's like, if you surround yourself with good people doing great things, eventually you're going to want to do those things. You're going to be inspired. You're going to learn. You're going to have the opportunity to really put in some good work at some high levels with other high level achievers, you know? So I think that network and who you surround yourself with is huge.
I agree. And again, I think that's part of the bravery component, right? Yep. Because in some ways it's yep. hard to reach out to somebody that you don't know. Again, you know, the fortunate thing about working in universities is that we all have a passion for students. We have a passion for education. So there's some like-mindedness and there's opportunities for that network within one's university in which one doesn't have to quite step out on the ledge as much as if you're cold messaging somebody on LinkedIn, for example. But you shouldn't be scared to do that either, right? You should take the opportunity to say, hey, here's who I am. Can we have, I've seen the work that you do. You're doing great work. Can we have that conversation? I mean, I did that here in San Marcos. So I reached out to my colleagues at the other two institutions in the area, Cal State San Marcos and Palomar College, which is a two-year institution, say, hey, I'm new in town. I've got this role. You know, I was only in San Marcos in Southern California for 6 months before COVID hit. I was only here for really 2 months before I was appointed interim CAO. And I reached out and I said, hey, let's start some conversations because I think you can help me. I can help you. I've got this experience. You've got great experience. Can we start to get together? And then that, you know, and they told a friend and they told two friends and they told three friends and so on and so on and so on. And you build your network that way.
Yeah. I mean, I tell my first trimester students from day one, you should have been networking already, but the next best time to start your networking is now if you haven't. So, you know, I think that I can't even, I was trying to tell them, I don't know that I can remember a job that I got basically through an application. Like at some point there was somebody there who knew me and referred me or who knew somebody else was looking for a position that I could fill. It was, you know, all about the network and, you know, that becomes so important if you want to try to work your way up.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, the irony of how I got this job was through a cold call message through LinkedIn. And the only reason I was on LinkedIn is because I had a former doctoral student who said, hey, there's this new kind of connection network platform that you might, I've joined it, you might want to join it. And so I joined it because of her and because I was on it, you know, I get a message from a recruiter for the position here at USA. And again, it was an opportunity that I was open to and said, hey, let's at least explore this. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I've gone from dean to president and chief academic officer. And that's the thing too, Scott, that I'm sure you impart to your students is don't waste a possible opportunity, right? Have your eyes and ears open for what might be in front of you, for what might be next. And if you have your eyes and ears open, there's tremendous and replete opportunities, even if and when you're not looking for them.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you go through the process and you don't get the position or you don't achieve whatever you're trying to achieve, it's a learning experience. You know, at least you've got some experience on the interview process or what they're looking for or how you can improve for the next round. You know, it's definitely, like you said, the bravery is a big thing. Just go for it. You know, I love that. Well, Brian, tell us a little bit about your vision and what's up for you in the next couple of years now, either, you know, for yourself or for the university, you know, as you take this new position and really, you know, strive into it, essentially.
Absolutely. So I'll frame it in terms of, you know, I don't want to speak to or for higher ed. So I'll be a little bit domain general and then more domain specific. Perhaps around the university, which are in my mind linked together, and also initiatives that I certainly try to focus on and move forward at other universities where I've been at, and so I think, you know, historically we have been too siloed. That we are raised as academics, you know, present company, myself, that is included in our own guild, in our own domain of our single profession. It's not that we don't learn about or know that there are other professions out there that can be additive to the professional singular work that we do. But I would say it's episodic and rare rather than continuous and institutional. And so for me, one of the big initiatives that, again, I've tried to work on at other places, but I think is important in higher ed in general, and certainly for a health sciences university, is to institutionalize interprofessional education and practice. And it can't be random collisions, although those are important too. And I'm not minimizing those random collisions of you know, two students or two faculty members from various professions, you know, meeting in the hallway or meeting, you know, over coffee. That is important as well. But we really have to institutionalize those collisions to make them intentional and explicit, rather than episodic and almost exotic, right? I mean, sometimes they're so minimal that when they do happen, they're rare. They also happen I think they also need to happen at regular intervals, with, you know, some opportunity for IPE within every class, every term, every year, from the beginning of a student's journey. And again, I think this occurs not only at the graduate level in a health sciences university, but also undergraduate in a general ed or core curriculum, in not only the health sciences, but the sciences and the humanities. And I think those are all linked together, because, you know, we also talk about not only the technical skills. And so this is sort of the second point, which is, you know, we shouldn't just be teaching technical approaches to our work. And again, I don't want to situate this only in rehab or health sciences, that it has to be more encompassing and include not only content to be learned, but also the integration of that content within higher level communication, thinking, problem solving skills that we often, I hate this term of soft skills, but again, I think it's those components of being a sentient human that we have to add to our elements, right? Because when we're out in humanity, we've got to be able to work with and communicate a variety of individuals. So I'll kind of stop there and maybe see if you have some comments or questions around that. We can go from there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, first off, that's why this podcast was started, right? We've had doctors on here, nurses, OT, speech, dentists. We reached out to a bunch of different fields to talk about what their, you know, educational system looks like and how their graduate schools and you know, further education schools look like and higher learning. And we tried to find some best practices, some worst practices, some things, you know, that maybe we could use that intellectual trespassing and borrow from other programs and say, hey, let's try that. That sounds cool. Or like, wow, nursing does a great job with simulations. We need to do more simulation, right? And we're very fortunate to have a great simulation lab. So like, these are the kind of things that we love talking about and love having guests on to kind of talk about so that we can learn how to learn, right? I mean, that's the big thing. I think we need to show people like there are some pretty cool things going on out there. We just need to figure them out and see how we can all use them to you know, get better at what we do when it really comes down to patient interaction and you know, getting those results from patients. You know, and I think too, the second point there is like, okay, well, soft skills, you know, you can call them what you want, but at the end of the day, we have to be able to communicate, you know, to whether it be our students or our patients or, you know, other clinicians. There has to be that open lines of communication, and it has to feel like a safe place to be able to, like, you know, interact when we're out there in the healthcare field and trying to get good results for patients. You know, we can't be, you know, stepping on each other's toes or you know, talking down to people or you know, poo-pooing like certain groups or certain professions because they don't do what we do or they don't know what we know. I think, you know, part of it is it's on us to like go out there and explore and find out more about what they do, dive deeper, ask questions, you know, be thoughtful, be open-minded to how we can help them and how they can help us. You know, so I think that's huge.
I agree. And if we don't do that, it becomes a cliche of the elephant is, you know, defined only by that part as you're blindfolded that you're touching. Right. And so, you know, that's not the elephant. And you've got to take the blinders off and also, you know, look at the entire whole and understand how other people are perceiving that elephant in order to really understand it to the extent that you can. I mean, I know when I've sat in on simulations here on this campus, and again, we have OT and PT on this campus. We don't have SLP, so you know I'm the SLP representative, and so you know when I hear the OT and PT students speaking to a patient that is simulating aphasia, right? They have a language problem because they've had a stroke, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, you were talking to this person as if they are in a doctoral program in OT or PT, rather than the kind of language that you ought to be using with a patient, you know, who's just had a stroke. And oh, by the way, you know, they don't have their glasses on, and it's likely because they're a senior, they have hearing loss. You haven't considered either of these things in the communication that you're having. And so, you know, when I raise these issues, you know, it's like a light bulb goes on. In the same way, when, you know, on the other side, they say, hey, look, if you think about seating and positioning your patient in a different way, that your communication will probably improve. You know, we can also work on other areas of each of our domains if we have that integrated focus rather than coming at it only from the lens of SLP or OT or PT is just three examples. Relatedly to me is, you know, one of the other visions that I have, not only for us, but also for other institutions, is the increased creation of academic health centers without necessarily having to have a medical or dental school attached. Because I think I have the numbers right, you know, somewhere about 15% of academic health centers do not include a medical school or dental school. So they're not required to be part of an academic health center. And so again, I think to further perpetuate and integrate our professions and our backgrounds with what's going on in the larger healthcare system, we need to not exist as an island unto ourselves, to paraphrase Milton, right? We've got to look inward and outward simultaneously.
Yeah. And I think to bring up another point that you kind of touched on, you know, I think we need to start exploring our value to society, not just in our patient care and our skills and technician level stuff, because that almost downgrades the profession a little bit, right? We need to be able to do that stuff, but we need to be able to take our knowledge that we've learned through our graduate programs and our skill sets that we've learned through our graduate programs and utilize those for bigger impact, bigger picture stuff, right? We can write books, we can go and help at community centers, we can lecture and educate on our knowledge and our skill set, right? We can go out in the community and have 50 moms come and talk about, you know, postpartum education as far as, you know, exercises and mommy and me time, you know, and like physical therapists and speech therapists and occupational therapists, we have this grand knowledge that can help so many people. And I think we need to start diversifying our view on what our profession is and what they can do to really make an impact. And I talked a little bit about that in my book on, you know, multiple revenue streams for healthcare providers. We can do more than just the typical 9-to-5 clinician, right? There's so many opportunities for us out there to make a bigger impact and to help people. And I think that really becomes, you know, something that we need to start looking at in the future too.
And may I say, sir, amen. And so, you know, I'll add two items to that. And it ties back to the discussion we were having earlier about how people can further their careers or you know, kind of consider possible leadership opportunities. And one is to humble brag. It is like, I think as academics, our mindset is the thing speaks for itself. Our work will speak for itself. And somebody will notice what that work is. And sometimes that is the case, but I think it's the rare case and not the mode. And so it is okay to put your work out there. It is okay to say, you know what? I just published this paper and here's why it's important. Here's the research I'm doing with my colleagues. Here's this innovative teaching approach that I've tried with great success, and let people know about it because, you know, as I say to my wife all the time, honey, I love you, but I'm not a mind reader. If you need me to do something, just tell me you need me to do something. And I think it's the same with academics. We're not so great at humble bragging.
And I think, you know, I tell, again, my students to, you know, promote yourself unapologetically. You've got the skills. You've got the letters after your name. You've got that education. Go out there and use it and go into your passion and promote it. Because like you said, not you could be the best physical therapist in the world, but if you don't promote yourself, nobody's going to come see you. They don't know who you are, where you are, what you're doing. You've got to promote yourself, you know? So I love that.
And I think as part of that, Scott, is, you know, I think one thing we're not good at, again, as both academics and I think, you know, as clinician educators, teacher educators, is to write for a lay audience. You know, that we spend our time writing for, you know, academic journals or, you know, abstracts or presenting at, again, typically domain specific conferences and meetings, you know, that we call symposia. So even the name is not inviting to anybody other than those in the guild. And I know, you know, my experience, and again, anecdotal for sure, is I get more feedback and interaction when I've written blog posts as opposed to my research articles, where, you know, maybe one person will actually email me at that, you know, for correspondence contact at so-and-so. I don't get those, but when I write a blog post, there's a lot of interaction if I put something out on social media. And so it's why I joined Twitter 10 years ago in the first place, was really to first connect with other speech therapists, and have had some really engaging interactions. I think if you curate your followers and who you're following correctly, it'll be a source for good rather than one that just, you know, ends up being depressing because all you do is doom scroll.
Yeah, absolutely. I could talk about this stuff all day. This fires me up so much, but I also want to be respectful of your time. And so I have one final question that we ask all our guests, and that's, if you could change one aspect of higher education, whether that be, you know, DPT or SLP or OT or whatever, what aspect would you change? Why would you change it? And how would you change it?
So again, I'm going to try and tie some pieces together with answering that question. And you touched on it a moment ago, and I was going to mention it, but I'm glad I kind of held off and waited until right now. And that is for higher ed to advocate for itself in the same way that you extol your students to advocate for themselves, that nobody's going to advocate for them like they are. And it's a little unmooring at this point in the 21st century that higher ed has to advocate for itself and show its relevance. But that is the position that we're in. And again, I think because we don't tend to communicate with or write to a non-guild audience or non-professional audience, we are pretty terrible at advocating for ourselves and showing the relevance of higher education and how it lifts, again, to use your phrase, lifts all the boats up simultaneously, that I think it's misperceived as an insular, small c conservative, never changing, difficult to corral institution, when in fact, you know, my experience, particularly at USA, is 180 degrees out of phase with that more generalized notion of a very staid, old, lackluster, non-innovative institution that is difficult and not prone to change. And we have to show and communicate and not just let our work speak for itself, but be intentional and aggressive in the sense of not being afraid, again, that bravery word, to go out and extol the virtues and the outcomes of higher ed, and in particular graduate higher education, to the importance of society.
Yeah, that's a great way to close this up and wrap up a great discussion. Well, Brian, again, thank you so much for your time and for coming on to share your knowledge and you know, all things higher ed with our audience. Where can people reach out to you and get in touch with you if they have any questions or follow up or just want to see what you're up to on social media and stuff these days?
Yeah, I would love to interact with people. Again, you know, even you know, all the roles I've had, if you get in touch with me, you are going to get a response. And so a couple of ways, my email is bgoldstein, B-G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N at usa.edu. I'm on Twitter at goldstein25, or search me on LinkedIn. And I'd love to connect with people and further the conversation.
Great.
We'll Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your time and the opportunity.
Absolutely. We'll put all those links in the show notes for everybody so that it's easy to find. And again, Brian, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Same here, Scott. Appreciate what you do and for our students.